I've got an interview today with a researcher from Washington University, and his name is
University of Washington.
sorry, University of Wa- Why is that two different places? Or I just said it wrong.
Yeah, it is.
University of Washington, Stephen Guionet. I actually found him through a reader on both of our blogs, I guess, noticed that we both put a blog post up with the same title, or at least some same words in the title. And so I bounced over to Stefan's blog and started reading, and I found it pretty interesting. And then it turns out that Stefan's field of research and his background is something that I found pretty interesting, and he might be able to give us some insights into body fat regulation and basically just, you know, how we store and burn fat. And I mean, this will be educational for me, so I think it'll be educational for everyone listening. Stefan, I'll let you kind of, if you can just give our listeners a little description of yourself and what you're doing, and then we can just get rolling on a talk about body fat and how we burn fat and store fat.
Sure. So I am a postdoc studying body fat regulation, and basically our research centers around mechanisms by which the systems that regulate body fat can be dysregulated and obesity can occur. So basically, we're looking at this hormone called leptin. And leptin is kind of a feedback signal from body fat to the rest of the body, indicating nutrient stores. So, leptin is a hormone that's produced in proportion to the amount of fat that you carry, and it signals to the brain whether you should either eat more or eat less, or burn more energy or burn less energy. So basically, the more fat you have, the more leptin you have, and the more your body decides to burn energy rather than store it, and eat less food rather than eat more food. And conversely, if you have low body fat stores, that's a potent signal to reduce energy expenditure and increase energy intake. So basically, it's a feedback system that's designed to keep body fat within a specific, fairly narrow, healthy range. And yeah, so we're studying the mechanisms by which that system can break down.
Okay. And so what where you so now with the leptins, the concept of leptin, is there any research you've come across indicating that it acts independently, or does it act in sort of concert with any other hormones, or does it, I guess what I'm trying to say is, does it seem as though it may actually be a master controller, or is it controller along with other hormones?
Well, there's a very complex interplay between leptin and other hormones and other more local signaling molecules. So I don't want to say that it's leptin acting alone, but I would say that the unique thing about leptin that no other hormone does is, or no other known hormone does, is it's that feedback signal that's going from fat tissue to the parts of the body that regulate fat mass. And it's a negative feedback signal. So basically, there's no other hormone that has that kind of potent negative feedback relationship coming out of fat tissue.
Right. Okay. And so, and is it? It's basically coming from adipose tissue.
Exactly.
Right. So, for anyone listening, adipose tissue is just the stored fat that we're all interested in getting rid of. So. As compared to like intramuscular fat. Does it actually get secreted from things like intramuscular fat too?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. So, but from what we understand so far, it's mainly adipose.
Yeah, I mean, it correlates well with overall adipose tissue. I don't know if it comes from intramuscular and other types of ectopic fat, but I mean, those are typically a relatively minor proportion of fat stores in any case.
Well, yeah, sure. Okay, and so then, where are you getting to, or at least what's your take on the concept of body fat regulation? Is this, are you getting to, I mean, to me it sounds like this might suggest that there's, I don't want to say a set point, but some kind of set range.
Yeah, and yeah, I think there is, and you can see that. It's quite apparent if you look in the studies. You starve people, and they will lose fat and some lean tissue. But as soon as you stop starving them, they put it back on. And where do they end up? They end up pretty much right back where they started, typically, or maybe a little bit heavier. And the same thing, you see the same thing with overfeeding studies. If you can get a volunteer in a study to overeat by 50% of calories or so, they will gain fat, and they'll gain some lean tissue as well. And then as soon as you stop telling them to eat, they'll lose it, pretty much all of it. So, I mean, there's clearly some kind of so you can use the analogy of the thermostat here that regulates temperature. There is in the body what you could call an adipostat. So it's like a thermostat for fat mass that always tries to come back to a certain set point. However, and what's been shown is that's true for both lean people and overweight people. So the body of a lean person wants to be lean. The body of an overweight person wants to be overweight. But, you know, someone might say, well, that doesn't work because how does a lean person become overweight? Because, you know, obviously some people do that. So what we believe is happening is over time there's a change in that set point. There's a change in the adipostat that decides what fat mass you want to defend. So even though you gained weight, your body is still defending that gained weight. It just changed the weight that it was trying to defend.
Now, okay. Now, couldn't that not also change down?
Yeah. I mean, hypothetically, sure. It can change up. And so this comes to the crux of the matter as far as I'm concerned, because most of the fat loss advice that's coming out of the mainstream is basically advice to reduce calories. But the problem is that, well, A, it's been shown that that's not effective. Just telling someone to eat less is not effective in the long term, because your leptin goes down, you get hungry, and you end up eating. You can't resist that discomfort indefinitely.
Oh yeah, and just to be clear. So what the feedback loop, the thing that it's doing, isn't magically creating fat out of nowhere. It's actually causing, what you're saying is the feedback loop is stimulating hunger.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, correct. So stimulating hunger and reducing energy expenditure. So it does both.
So you end up like being less active and being more hungry.
Correct. Right. Yeah, less physically active. Your basal metabolic rate goes down. The efficiency of your muscular contractions goes up. So for the same movement, you expend less energy, fewer calories. And the trade-off for that is that you also become weaker. Your muscles become weaker but more efficient.
Okay, that's interesting.
So basically, just telling people to eat fewer calories doesn't work. So the crux of the matter, you know, that's because of this set point. So the question is, at that point,
okay,
if you can't just tell someone to eat fewer calories, how do you get them to lose weight?
Well, okay, hang on. But for people who have followed, so when you say they can't, it doesn't work, you mean over time? Like, it clearly it works if people do it for it.
You can definitely. Go ahead, finish your question.
Well, I'm just going to say it clearly works for some degree. It clearly works for some amount of people for some degree of time. But you're saying over time, you're just going to find yourself becoming hungrier and hungrier until the point where you start eating your way back up to a certain size.
Right, exactly. And it's because of these hormones. You know, we have this idea that is really culturally determined that, you know, we have full control over our, you know, what our body does. But the fact is that, I mean, in the end, yeah, sure, you can choose not to eat. But in the end, there are all these hormones that are very strongly suggesting that you do certain things, and it's very difficult to resist them indefinitely, and that's reflected in the studies. If you look, I mean, like you said, if you restrict calories, you can lose weight. There's no doubt about that. You can lose fat if you restrict calories enough. There's no doubt about it. But the question is, in a free-living person who has access to food, as much food as they want to eat.
And let me stop you right there. That's the caveat to all of this, right? Being in modern Western societies where food is abundant. Like, I highly doubt somebody in a country where food is actually scarce is having this discussion right now.
Right, of course. I mean, if you don't have enough calories,
it doesn't matter what any of, like, you're just going to be
right.
You're just going to be
lean
regardless.
That's true, but it's important to keep in mind that human beings, we didn't really evolve in a hypocaloric environment. I mean, if you look at hunter-gatherers, they have access typically to more food than they can eat. They actually are skimming off the best calories in whatever respective environment they're in, and that's why they survive famine so much better than agricultural populations. And I'm making generalizations here, and there are exceptions, such as hunter-gatherers that rely on very specific food sources, like the Inuit. They did starve periodically.
Mm-hmm.
But in most modern hunter-gatherers, they may have periods where they're eating fewer calories seasonally, but there's not really any evidence that they were calorie-restricted for the majority of the time.
Sure, okay.
So my point is just that I don't think that we really evolved. I mean, you did have to work for your food. It's not like it was just there for you to grab, but it was there. You know, if you were hungry, you could eat during our evolution is, to my knowledge, what was the case.
So in this case, if we calorically restrict for some period of time, and we can, you know, sort of do the mind over matter thing, or the will our way to it.
Mm-hmm.
This concept of this feedback loop will eventually put you back all the way back, maybe part of the way back. What have you seen in the data to suggest what seems to happen to people?
They regain it all, pretty much. I mean, if you look at, there's been so many studies done on this, and most of them show that on average, the average person will regain all of the body fat lost by a year or a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously, if there's someone who has an iron will, if there's an individual who has an iron will and they're willing to fight themselves for years, you know, indefinitely, then yeah, they will be able to keep it off.
Now maybe the interesting thing there, and I'm just kind of just pulling stuff, just wondering. I wonder if there's a threshold where you can will that response to the point where perhaps that response starts changing, and maybe you can influence it not in a mind over matter way, but if it goes enough months and years, perhaps that response recognizes that that's just where you're trying to be. I don't know.
Well,
obviously, that those trials may not have been done because maybe no one has managed to stick it out for that long.
Yeah.
What would you think of that as at least in a hypothesis of an idea?
I think it's unlikely because the problem is that the longer you're on a diet like that, the more your body adapts to that low calorie situation and tries to conserve energy even more. Things like thyroid hormone activity go down. That's one of the things that determines how much energy your body burns and your temperature and metabolic rate. Thyroid activity goes down and pretty much shuts everything down. So I think your body actually becomes more efficient at conserving calories over time. I mean, again, you could do it. It's just an amount of willpower that most people don't possess.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, the big question is, can you change that set point?
And that is the question. And so what do you think?
Well, I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I think almost everybody hopes so.
I think that it can be changed, at least somewhat. I mean, there are studies suggesting that it can be changed. Basically, what I've been looking for is studies that don't involve deliberate calorie restriction where people are losing fat. So anything that you do that does not involve saying directly, eat fewer calories, that causes fat loss, I think is a potential candidate for something that resets the fat mass set point.
Okay. And, can you explain that? Because I'm trying to picture what that would be.
Well, for example, changing diet composition. Just telling people, you know, not saying anything about calories, but saying, hey, why don't you cut out the carbohydrate in your diet, for example. And that's one of the things that has been shown to lead to fat loss, is eating a low-carbohydrate diet without restricting calories. So,
okay, you're saying without the acknowledgement that you're restricting calories, but even though you still end up eating less.
That's correct. You do end up eating less.
So you're trying to okay, so let me see if I'm understanding you. It's trying to find solutions that aren't that don't require you to count calories or try to figure out a lower calorie, but a way you could, I don't like this word, but naturally just eat the way you eat, but it still works out to be less and you're still satisfied.
That's the key is why would your body be satisfied with fewer calories? I mean, that's the big question. Why are people eating fewer calories when no one told them to eat fewer calories? And I think that points to a hormonal change in the fat mass set point that's occurring due to that change in composition of the food.
Hmm.
So I'm not huge on low-carbohydrate diets. I think they have their place, but I do think that is one potential intervention that in overweight people can influence the fat mass set point.
Now, go ahead.
I was just going to rattle off a couple other things.
Yeah, sure, by all means.
So one of the things that seems to be involved that is I feel is very likely to be – there's some controversy still in the field, but I feel it's very likely to be involved is inflammation. So inflammation is one of the things that – can cause leptin resistance. I mean, it appears to be, at least in rodents, the thing that causes leptin resistance in the hypothalamus. And, sorry, I didn't explain that. The hypothalamus is basically the main location in the body that responds to leptin. So, I mean, many places respond to leptin, but the hypothalamus is really the central command station of influencing energy balance and in response to leptin.
Right. And so you're talking about an inflammation of the hypothalamus itself?
Certain populations of cells in the hypothalamus, yep, and it causes them to be resistant to the actions of leptin.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So now are you suggesting dietary causes for this inflammation?
Yeah, I think there are likely to be some dietary causes for that inflammation. First of all, anytime I hear the word inflammation, one of the first things I think of is the balance of omega-6 to omega-3 fats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, how much omega-6 are we eating? You know, the answer is a lot compared to evolutionary standards. And how much omega-3 are we eating? And the answer is not enough, or I don't know. It probably depended on the group, but probably less.
I think it's pretty safe in North America to say the balance isn't very good.
The balance is not good. The balance is not good at all.
Yeah.
And what's worse is the sources of our omega-6s are industrial seed oils. You know,
mm-hmm.
These oils that didn't exist prior to industrial machines and petroleum-based solvents required to extract them, things like corn oil and soybean oil and safflower oil. Well, I guess that one you can use a press for, but I think you get the picture.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it comes down. So I mean, some of this problem is, well, maybe a good chunk of this problem even comes down to the food supply chain that we kind of are all living with here.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, going with the flow in the U.S. is, well, cause disease, basically. You know, we know that. We know that our food system is fundamentally flawed.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that nutrient balance plays a big role in it, too, in terms of nutrient status, like fat-soluble vitamins, like vitamin D, minerals such as magnesium. Those are all things that have been shown to influence inflammation and have also, under highly controlled conditions, been shown to influence body fat mass.
So then let me put this in context. So to draw a contrast here, clearly there's people who don't have a weight issue. So in them,
mm-hmm.
there's can they be looked at as a model for what's going on is obviously working versus in people who tend to overeat? I mean, obviously there's a group of people out there who just eat just enough to stay lean and they're perfectly happy and it doesn't require any effort. That's just what they do. And then there's the group of people who are, you know, browsing around on our blogs trying to find out how to lose weight who mm-hmm. are either, I mean, it sounds to me like we're getting to the point where we're finding out, I mean, and like you said, it's kind of obvious there's something genetic anyways, because why do they just feel like eating more than the people who just choose to not eat beyond what they need?
Well, there's certainly a genetic component to it. And the way I like to think about it is that genes control a person's susceptibility to the damaging effects of a poor lifestyle. So if you go back 40 years in the United States, half of the people who are obese wouldn't have been obese. And if you go back 100 years, it's even less. It's probably half of that or even less. So, you know, obviously there's no genetic change that has occurred in the intervening time. And if you go and you look at hunter-gatherer cultures, there is very little overweight and virtually no obesity. And then as soon as they switch, you know, not just hunter-gatherers, non-industrial populations that are living agricultural lifestyles as well, as soon as they switch to a modern industrial diet, they start having body fat accumulation.
And things like diabetes that they never used to have, too.
Correct.
Right. So it's partly genetic and it's partly the environment.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can say that for any disease. But
I think that's a fair statement, yeah.
I mean, in my mind, if you want to put the word cause on anything, the cause is the diet. I'll be broader about diet and or lifestyle. Because of the fact that the genes haven't changed, what's changed is the lifestyle
mm-hmm.
and the diet. So
then given the change of the diet and the lifestyle, the people who, like you said, over the last few generations, the rate of obesity has gotten worse. So given the change in diet and lifestyle that we're presently faced with has allowed these obvious genetic differences to sort of show through now.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So you can think of it in terms of an analogy. If you take, let's say you take 10 rats or 10 mice, if you give them rat poison at just the right dose, you can kill half of those mice.
Right.
And a casual observer who didn't know that, or okay, let me take a step back here. Let's say you have your 10 rats, you give them rat poison, it kills half of them. You then do a study and you find out that the ones that survived had a mutation in one of their vitamin K related proteins, which is involved in susceptibility to rat poison. And let's say you have a casual observer who knows about that, but doesn't know that you gave him rat poison. That person will say, oh, well, I guess, you know, that version of the vitamin K related protein is lethal because the rats who had that, they all died.
Right.
But really,
right.
The gene wasn't lethal. What was lethal was the poison.
Exactly.
And that half of them were resistant because of their genetic background. So that's the way that I see these modern diseases is, yes, you have a spectrum of genetic susceptibility although it's not just genetics. You know, people like to think of it in terms of genetics, but it could have many causes. It could be the, you know, environment, that the maternal nutritional status while the child was in the uterus. It could be lifestyle that gets passed down from generation to generation. There are a lot of factors. You know, people tend to think in terms of genetics, but there are a lot of things that people call genetics that aren't necessarily genetics.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, despite that, genetics obviously play a role. So basically the role is to modify how people respond to these negative diet and lifestyle factors.
Okay, so so that was a fair bit to digest there. So we've examined some of the different things that you think that might be going on here, and that there could be this basically a set point, and that we all have our own, I guess you could say, based on our nature and our nurture, we have our own predisposed susceptibility to the environment that we're in. Is that a fair statement?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then given that, and then obviously we can just go look in the mirror and know how our lives have been to decide where we think we fall on that susceptibility spectrum. So if someone goes and stands in front of the mirror and they, you know, have a visible six pack, they're like, well, I guess it's not me. Mm-hmm. But other people who were like, gee, I wish I could get rid of some weight, now they've got some work to do. Let's get to, I guess, the what can we do about it section here, and what at least are your sort of ideas of what we can do, maybe some, I don't know, let's just talk about what, I mean, besides the sort of heroic will of just caloric restriction, which we know works for some degree, for some degree of people, for some degree of time, what else do you think, what would you suggest, or at least what are you, like, thinking about for longer-term solutions?
Well, I think diet quality is really the key. So the three of my least favorite dietary ingredients, white flour, sugar, and industrial seed oils, I think likely all have some role to play in excess body fat accumulation, and also getting rid of them has a role to play in loss of body fat. So, you know, unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot known about how to effectively reduce body fat, so a lot of this is going to be speculation.
Mm-hmm.
Let me rephrase that. Not a lot is known about how to effectively reset the fat mass set point. So a lot of this is going to be speculation, but
right.
My overall...
And let's just make sure everyone gets what we're saying here. We're not saying you can't just restrict calories. Clearly, we both agree that restricting calories causes you to lose weight, but what we're trying to do, or at least what we're speculating now at, is how to reset your sort of body fat set point so you don't want to keep eating back up to, if you lose weight, keep eat your way back up to the weight you were just at.
Right.
So it's the difference between a reduction to lose weight or a resetting of how you are.
Yeah, that's right. To have your body naturally want to be at a lower weight instead of forcing it to be at that weight and fighting it as it wants to climb back up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my basic philosophy for all diet and health related things is go with what has worked for other cultures. So what are other cultures doing that don't have problems with obesity? So, I mean, basically the difference is modern Western industrial foods. So the three things I listed, white flour, sugar, and industrial seed oils, I think actually wheat products in general are problematic for many people, and some people will lose weight just eliminating wheat from their diet, and any other type of processed food. I think there are a number of factors that I could point to in those changes that would help potentially reset the fat mass set point by modulating inflammation. And one of those is better nutrient status. Another one is omega-3-6 balance. And the other factor that I believe plays a prominent role is what's going on with your gut flora. So the intestine I'm sure most people know, is just full of bacteria, particularly the large intestine, and they are there to help us digest food. And the body and these bacteria interact to a very substantial degree, and one influences the other. And one of the ways that you can influence the bacteria that are in your gut is by taking fermentable fibers, by eating fermentable fibers. So there's been quite a bit of research with a particular fiber called inulin or oligofructose, and that one gets readily fermented by the gut bacteria, and they produce these little short-chain fatty acids. And they've shown that if you add that to the diets that normally make an animal obese, they put on much less fat, and they don't get insulin resistant as much. They don't get diabetes as much. It just makes them generally more resistant to the diseases that are the rodent equivalents to the metabolic diseases that are common in our day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you look at the modern American diet, one of the things that characterizes it is a low content of soluble fibers, of fiber in general, but particularly soluble fiber.
Sure.
And there are actually some trials in humans. There's one showing that giving oligofructose to overweight humans causes them to lose weight, or lose fat, I should say. It's not a big effect. It's a modest effect. I mean, one of the things you have to deal with is it's always easier to prevent a problem than to cure it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously a challenge, but the fact that there was a significant fat loss, I think, is telling, and it's consistent with the evidence in rodents. And they've also done studies showing that it improves insulin sensitivity in humans. It improves mineral uptake from the large intestine. So as far as I can tell, it's just a good idea to eat vegetables and fruits that are high in soluble fiber. So that particular type of fiber is found in high concentrations in Jerusalem artichokes, burdock, jicama, chicory, onions and leeks, and certain other plants that our ancestors probably ate quite a bit of when we were hunter-gatherers. So I think the gut flora plays a pretty important role, as well as foods that determine the body-wide level of uncontrolled inflammation.
Right. So dealing with the we're dealing, we got an idea here about gut flora. We have an idea about soluble fiber, and I guess kind of wrapped into both of that, we have an idea of kind of normalizing or getting our omega 6 to our omega 3 balance in a better spot compared to where I think it's safe to say, if you just cross sectioned 100 people in North America, it would be pretty far off.
Right.
And is there any other ideas in there?
Well, I think the nutrient density of the diet is an important thing that I mentioned, but maybe I could just expand on it a little bit more. You know, whole foods are more nutritious, obviously, so fruits and vegetables and no white sugar. White sugar is, you know, basically the definition of an empty calorie.
Yeah.
So when and vitamin D.
Yeah. I was just going to say vitamin D may be one of the other sort of obvious ones that it's starting to get to the point where the data seems to be. I mean, I'm not a big proponent of taking vitamins, but that one's starting to seem to be like it. If there's one we seem to be, if there was one I was going to gamble on, it would be that one worth taking, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm really not a proponent of supplements, but here in Seattle, when we can't make any vitamin D for, I think, almost 6 months of the year, I do take some in the winter. You know, the data's not all in yet, but I think there is substantial amount of evidence that having a good vitamin D status at the very least can prevent some degree of fat gain. Whether it can reverse it is another question, and I'm not convinced that it can, because there was a recent trial that came out that showed after 1 year of high-dose vitamin D3 supplementation, overweight people did not lose fat. But I think there's quite a bit of data that it is involved in preventing that gain in the first place.
Right. So back to your original point about prevention versus cure.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, it seems like a lot of the strategies that you're mentioning, it's not necessarily new news. It's more like just get your diet in order, basically eat whole foods and stay away from processed foods. The whole, like, go around the outside edge of the grocery store instead of the aisles.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I think that really is the most important take-home message. I feel like, you can refine that, and I think there is a lot of refinement that you can do, because I also think that, people think, oh, let's eat whole foods, let's go eat whole grains. But I think unless you understand how traditional cultures were really preparing their whole grains, which is not the same way we prepare our whole grains, then you're not really going to be replicating what they were doing, and you're not going to be getting the same effect.
Sure. It's kind of like our current food system and the way food's delivered, and even the price points it's at and its availability and all of those sort of things really make it a bit of a game. Like, even if we have the answer, like you just said, like, what does even whole foods mean? Like, that's not even necessarily an obvious statement.
No, it's really hard. I have a lot of sympathy for people trying to figure out how to eat, because that's something that throughout all of human history was simply dictated by your cultural traditions.
And what was available.
Yeah, well, it was what was available, and but the way that you prepared it and what you decided to plant or what you decided to harvest as well were partly dictated by cultural traditions. And if you look at, the more I learn, the more I understand that many of those traditions are extremely valuable and they had important reasons for them.
Sure. And the more troubling thing is those traditions seem to be eroding and disappearing rapidly from one generation to the next.
Yeah, it's true. And that's why we have to learn as much as we can about them now.
Well, yeah. I mean, thank God for the internet at this point, because I think if we went another couple generations, it would be all but gone.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the most important people to learn food from is probably your grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you that even my grandparents were eating mostly processed food.
Oh, really?
So, I mean, yeah, that may not be true for everyone, but I think in terms of my lineage, I would need to go back even further than that to get really true unadulterated American cultural traditions,
That's very interesting. Yeah. I guess I just kind of showed my bias there. My grandparents were born in, even my parents were, I'm first generation North America, like in Canada. My parents were born in Italy, and my grandparents obviously live there, and they don't know anything about processed foods, or like, they only ever shopped at Italian stores and made everything from scratch. I remember one day, my grandmother, something happened, and she's always cooking. Like, if we were at her place, she would always, even if we were there just for half an hour or something was going on, she would always just start cooking. And we're like, you don't have to cook all the time. And so I think it was I can't remember what happened, but it was a situation where we didn't have a lot of time. So we just ordered in some food. Mm-hmm. And she was shocked that you could call somebody and then 20 minutes later food would show up. She's like, all of this just from that phone call? And she just couldn't believe it. She's like, it served, 12 people around the table. And she's thinking, it takes me like 8 hours to cook enough food to serve 12
right.
people. And they just did it in 20 minutes. And that's just an example of how different in one lifetime food has become.
Yeah, it's true. And what I said about my grandparents, I was talking about my American grandparents. I actually, on my other side of my family, my father's French, and they actually ate very well. And my dad cooked when I was growing up, and he's a very good cook as well. So I've got, both worlds going on in my history.
So then really we're talking about, So I guess we should start wrapping this up. So really, we're talking about, I guess, for starters, recognizing where you are on the spectrum. You're either listening to this call and weight loss isn't an issue, or you're listening and weight loss might be an issue. And in that case, it's partly your nature, it's partly your nurture, and then those two things mixed with the environment you're in right now is what you have to deal with. And wherever the science is so far, if there is this set point thing, and if it's possible to change it, we're not 100% sure how to change it yet. But it seems though that, I mean, I almost sound like, it almost seems like we're just saying the same thing over and over again that science has already told us. Get back to eating more whole foods and stay away from processed foods. And that's from what I'm gathering from you, that seems to have more intricate and intimate effects than we even think about, like things like the inflammation on the hypothalamus, things like what it's the gut microflora, like all the different things that people may not know why. They just know that it just makes sense. Fruits and vegetables just make sense, like things like that. So there seems to be more and more evidence piling up that that's probably a better way to eat.
Yeah, it's true, but frankly, the best evidence has been around for a long time, you know. It's the fact that cultures that don't have the things that we're trying to avoid are living like that, you know.
Oh, I 100% agree with you. I mean, I think I mean, actually, me and one of my business partners were actually looking at some statistics the other day on prevalence of where money is spent on food in North America. I think it was in just the United States, and food venues and the number of restaurants and convenience stores versus grocery stores. And the restaurants and convenience stores massively outnumber the grocery stores. And I mean, and as also with the amount of money being spent on them. So it's, people are kind of voting with their dollars, but I mean, if you don't need even much of an education in the food supply chain to realize that restaurants and convenience stores don't have the ability to stock a lot of whole fresh foods. I mean, convenience stores have none, and restaurants, based on spoilage and profit margins, can't really afford to have like a huge selection of whole fresh foods. They've got to use a lot of processed stuff. So it's just interesting that, I mean, even though we what you're saying makes perfect sense, and I don't think anyone would disagree with it, it seems to be super difficult in our society to do that.
Yeah, I mean the incentives are certainly not there, you know. It's not the easiest or cheapest route to go, you know. And it's for someone who's been eating processed food for their whole life, it may not even be the tastiest. Although I think that's something that you can work on and eventually you'll enjoy whole foods more. But initially I think it's definitely hard to break out of the prevailing diet.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm just trying to wonder what how that transition's even made. Like, is it a cold turkey thing, or kind of like how low? I mean, because you can go low calorie without making a transition in the diet, but if you want to make, and that's kind of what I've been telling people. I'm like, I don't even know, because I actually, frankly, I mean, I don't have an answer for how you make the dietary transition from foods you like to, from just the foods you're used to eating to the to. To the whoa, are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what just happened there. From the foods you're used to eating to the foods that maybe, because I kind of take the mantra that there's no such thing as good foods or bad foods. There's just the foods you'll choose to eat, and I mostly say that because I don't know what someone will tend to eat or tend not to want to eat, and I don't know how I could ever convince them to eat one thing over another. So even though we could probably dissect every food down to its constituent parts, its merits, its nutrient density, so to speak, the nutrients we can measure, not, and the nutrients we're not even sure that are there, or that have an effect. There's obviously more going on in a bowl of salad than there is in a bowl of white sugar. We just know there's more stuff going on in there. It's just, but how do you convince the person that they'd rather, it's in their best interest to have the salad and somehow find a way to enjoy it? And so that's why I'm just like, if you can just somehow eat less, even if it's just with the stuff you like, you're still ahead of the game than still eating too much with stuff you don't like. So what I'm trying to figure out is, and you know, based on what you were saying, and I agree with you, I just still haven't come up with the way. And I'm think this is what you're also trying to figure out is how do you make the change from foods you're used to foods that you can enjoy. You just have to learn how to. I think it has a lot to do with culinary arts. I think it's knowing how to make food taste good, like knowing how to make food that's good for you also tastes good, and doing that somehow in our society that doesn't really lend to that at all.
Well, I agree. I think that, but I think a lot of the problem, yeah, people don't know how to cook. That's a big part of the problem in modern America. But another part of the problem is that people have this idea that healthy food isn't supposed to taste good. And, you know, you hear pretty much everybody say that, but I mean it. I mean, it's not about getting rid of the fats you like. It's not about cutting fat off your steak. It's not about drinking skim milk. In my opinion, you can do all those things and you can be perfectly healthy because that's what we've always done. The things you want to get rid of are the ones that are kind of bland anyway, like processed vegetable oils and refined sugar. I mean, I know people like their cakes and stuff like that. That's always a difficult one, but you know, like who's going to say no to a steak and a potato?
Oh yeah, I agree.
That's what I'm talking about.
And I
And some
think,
vegetables, you know, steak
sure.
and potato and some vegetables and then
Yeah,
some fruit.
you're talking. Yeah, you're. Yeah. Oh no, I agree with you. You're talking about a meal at the Keg. I mean, it's good stuff. This is a me and a business partner. We actually have a term for it. We call it being a food snob. Actually, hold your food in a higher regard. Like actually, it's kind of like demand more of your food. Like actually, choose good food. Don't just eat. You know, what you can find at the convenience store type food. And I mean, I think that kind of lends to it anyways. I don't know. I think it's almost like in most areas of our, I don't know, if you want to say economic life or just in the marketplace, we look for deals. But I think food's the one place you don't, getting a bargain on food doesn't necessarily mean you're getting what you're not, it may not be a benefit to get the cheapest food.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but I mean, I think there are deals to be had on quality food if you look around for them. But yeah, I agree that, you know, just going for the absolute cheapest thing possible is going to get you into trouble.
Yeah, I agree. It just seems that if you, I guess because of the way the system is set up, the onus is on you to become a bit more of an educated shopper and maybe a more skilled cook. And then if you can at least do both of those, I don't know. I guess that's where I guess it would start. Once you really learn how to cook, you could maybe start making a transition from what's sort of there and available to what's you would rather have. That's also a better choice.
And you know, it's all about doing it one step at a time. You make one little change, you make another little change, and in 3 years, your diet's completely different.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would. I think that might have to be the way it works. I don't know that you can do the cold turkey thing. Some people may. Maybe some people that's just how they're built psychologically. But I can't see. I can't see the cold turkey thing lasting. I think it has to be in stages, and it's got to fit your lifestyle. Like you got to massage this kind of thing in. Well, I mean, that was pretty good talk. Do you have any parting remarks or anything you want to wrap up with or tips or comments?
You know, I will say one last thing. I've been very diet-centric in this interview, but I do think that there are other things that can influence, potentially influence the fat mass set point. One of them is exercise, and particularly high-intensity exercise, like sprint-type things. There is some promising evidence that that could help with fat loss, and anecdotally, as well as in at least one study, there's evidence that that does help with sustainable fat loss. And the other one is intermittent fasting. That has been effective for some people in reducing the fat mass set point, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's a shock to the body, and it may increase sensitivity to some of these hormones.
Oh, interesting. I wouldn't have even thought of that. Like, I know my business partner wrote a book about that, and I helped work on it, but I never considered intermittent fasting's effect on those hormones.
Yeah, well, as far as I know, it hasn't been directly shown to influence leptin sensitivity, but there is some evidence that it improves insulin sensitivity, and the fact that at least in some cases it can cause fat loss without people deliberately restricting their overall caloric intake suggests to me that it is influencing leptin in some way.
So I guess yeah. So I guess part of the trick here for sustainable weight loss is to not, is to somehow manage to do it without consciously trying to restrict calories.
Yeah, I mean, the strategy that has been pretty much proven not to work in the long term is just restricting calories. So, I mean, you know, if you want to eat until you're just satisfied instead of stuffed, that seems like a reasonable strategy as well. But starving yourself, I don't know. It's just, I don't feel like that's a good path.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's. Yeah, it's hard to. It's hard to tell. I guess we just need. I think there needs to be. We know it can get you down. It's just can. It's the maintenance that's the trick. It's how do you maintain? Because theoretically, the maintenance shouldn't be as difficult as getting down, because you can start eating a little bit more. And then from there, it's, you know, are you teasing yourself to eat even more than that, or can you actually either? I kind of look at it, there's three ways you can eat. You can eat in the way that caused you to be overweight. I guess in a way. So when I say eating in a way, it's an amount and a mix of food. Then there's some other reduced amount that you can force yourself down to, that cause you to lose weight. And then there's a third amount that you can maintain that weight. And that third spot is the spot where a lot of people aren't quite sure about, because they remember what it was like to be heavy, then they did some kind of diet down to get down, and now they're like, well, wait a minute, how do I maintain? And that's like a whole nother, that's like a the third stage of it.
And then it becomes harder over time. You know, these studies show that over time, when you restrict calories, your thyroid activity shuts down. And you can actually reverse that by giving those people leptin, suggesting that the reason that their thyroid activity is low is because their leptin activity is low, because their body is saying that they're not getting enough calories.
Have you ever looked at the research on non-exercise activity thermogenesis by Levine?
Is that like
Neat.
Little movements throughout the day?
Yeah, one of his theories, and I thought this one was a very interesting one, was that, and it's just a theory, but he had an evolutionary theory of why some people are heavier and some people are lighter, like kind of how what we're talking about. And he said perhaps, from an evolutionary standpoint, some people evolved to be net energy conservers and net energy spenders, and in which case, the spenders maybe, in cases of food scarcity, would go find it and bring it back, and that was their way of surviving. So they just got active and went and found food. And then the conserver's way was, well, if I wait this out and conserve energy, I'll last longer that way. And I don't know, it's an interesting theory that just some people, you know, it's two different ways around the same problem, I guess you could say. And it at least gives a framework for maybe trying to explain how we got on two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, it's possible that, I mean, it's a pretty hypothetical theory, but you know, in the end, if you look at non-industrial cultures, there's very little obesity, so no matter which gene they got, they're still going to be lean, you know?
It's kind of like what you were saying. It's not expressed yet because they're not in an environment to express it.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, that was great. I mean, that was really insightful. I don't really have anything left. Do you have anything to wrap up with?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Well, Stefan, thanks a lot. And I mean, I'm glad that common reader kind of threw me over towards your blog, and that was a great interview, and thanks a lot for the insights and the information.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.